Thank you very much, Shiva. Thanks for having me. I'd like to dedicate this talk to all those who've helped me on the spiritual path, Sangharachita, my Kalyana Mitras, my very good friend Joy, my children, and lots of other people along the way. I'm going to need to keep to my notes because otherwise I'm going to ramble off. So bear with me. So yes, we'll go through a little romp of 30 years. So I first met Bhante at Hampstead Town Hall when he was giving the series of talks on the Sutra of Golden Light. And I went there with my partner Richard, and I'd heard a lot about Bhante because Richard used to live with him in Muswell Hill with Siddhiratna prior to us living together. And we both recognised him as a great teacher, even though at the time, I must admit, I didn't understand a word of what he said about the Sutra of Golden Light. But I was searching for the meaning of life, and I thought this is the person, you know, because I'd been to various groups by then and this felt right. My children at that time were 8 and 12 years old, and we lived just by Hampstead Heath. And I felt I needed to explore the spiritual life on my own, so Richard and my relationship kind of fell apart. And I'd learned to meditate and came to the LBC. So there was actually a centre in Archway, which was near, but of course at Pundarika, but that closed because it was demolished. And I learned to meditate with Visantra over at a men's community in Kilburn, and then I came over here and did a course with Subhuti on the Wheel of Life, and that was it in a way. So the Dharma spoke to me, and I just plunged in, really, became a Mitra, and I was invited to set up a cafe. There was a derelict shop round the corner, and so Marlini and Padmasuri and Jayaprabha asked if I'd like to come and help start this shop. Well, at the time I was working in social services, teaching stained glass, and anyway, I said yes. So I used to, I found it was great. I loved working together and found that being in a team of four, which gradually expanded to 13, that was over time. It was just fantastic to be able to practice together. And Padmasuri was the manageress at the time, at the beginning, and she didn't believe in having machinery. So we used to make all the cakes by hand. You know, everything we did by hand. We had no chopping things like they had later on. But we loved it. We used to go on retreat together, and it was a wonderful way to progress in the spiritual life. So I used to drive over from Hampstead and come over. The traffic was pretty good in those days, and you could park free. So I'd drive over, I'd drive back and feed the children, and then drive back for a class a couple of nights a week. And, you know, I'd just to and fro. I didn't want to live over here. I found the air too polluted because I like lots of fresh air. So Hampstead's high, so that suited me. And anyway, the children were at school over there. So this is where I take a breather. And then after one of the retreats, we went on a women's retreat up at, because we had no Tara Loka then, and we used to hire these youth hostels. So we were in a youth hostel just outside of Glasgow. This is a women's retreat. And after the retreat, we had hours to wait before we got the train back to London. So we went to the Glasgow Art Gallery. I don't know if any of you have been there, but if you go on a Saturday, well, they did in those days, someone played the organ. So this organ was resounding in the whole place. And it was, you know, after a retreat, I was kind of really blown away. And I asked Marlene, you know, I said I wanted to be ordained. So that's when I asked, in about 1980, I guess. Okay, so there I was working in the cherry orchard. So after about 3 years of being in the cherry orchard, the team changed a lot. And we did get a bit of machinery. And, but my legs really ached from being on my feet all day. And I was doing stained glass at home. So the idea was that I'd start a stained glass business over here. So I had a very easy exit from the cherry orchard. We put a bowl on the counter for people to donate to collect money to buy glass for a window for the cherry orchard. And so we raised the money, and then I used the basement in here, downstairs, as a studio. And it had a lovely old stone floor, so, you know, the glass could go over. So I moved my studio over, and I trained about, I mean, I didn't kind of have much of a goal apart from make this window for the cherry orchard, but I trained about five Sangha sisters, and we had quite a nice time down there learning stained glass. But I made this window, which some of you might remember, which was a couple of peacocks. It was quite large, and it was put in the cherry orchard. And at some point there was an exhibition, a stained glass exhibition in the Orangery at Holland Park. And I was asked to enter this window, and Princess Michael of Kent opened the exhibition and shook my hand and said she really liked the window, and someone there offered me £1,000 for it. Anyway, I didn't take it. I, you know, put the window back. So that was the window. And yeah, very deep friendships were made, you know, with people on the team in the cherry orchard, and sort of every life around here, as it probably is now, is very much like a Buddhist village. So there was lots of, you know, wonderful sort of interaction with everybody, and very long, lifelong friendships have emerged from those times. So it was quite a haven down in the downstairs here. I used to cut people's hair as well for fundraising for Tara Loka, mostly guys. So they'd come in for a quick haircut, and it was towards the fundraising to buy Tara Loka, because I was a hairdresser years before that. Okay, so during the time of being a Mitra, one of my retreats was on the Isle of Mull. Some of you may have heard, we all went off to the Isle of Mull as Mitras, and most of us got the flu, raging temperatures, giving talks and, you know, trying to be on retreat, and most of us being in bed. And I had some idea that Banti would come over on a boat and ordain us, but anyway, he didn't. It's not the way it was planned. But, we had a very wonderful retreat. I think it was for about a month, and it was. I think it was a very strong spiritual boost to our practice. So my glasswork downstairs evolved. Ratnamala was one of the stalwarts working with me, and we started to have a stall in Covent Garden. So we'd sell our small pieces just once a week in Covent Garden. And then I went on to doing restoration work, because there's so many Victorian windows in London, so did loads and loads of restoration work. And then I started making new commissions. And also at home I did sort of more inspirational work, which was inspired by Vajrasattva, so I made a big Vajrasattva with crushed glass. And also, if some of you have been to Tiruvannamalai, the angel was inspired by Vajrasattva. He sort of transformed into an angel, and he's bringing down the three jewels into the kind of samsara, which is represented by very deep red and yellowy glass. So anyway, that's still there. And I always found retreats a very deep experience, kind of time to really kind of go right in and sort of crack up and come together again, basically. That's what seemed to used to happen to me. Time to integrate. Very deep meditations. I find it quite easy in a way to just trip off into dhyana, and I was very ungrounded and part of my feedback when I was a mitra was that I needed to be more grounded in my acupuncturist, and I needed to eat lots of yellow grain. So I used to eat millet every day and try and ground me. I'd get into all different states of consciousness, you know, that my friend Joy was very helpful in sorting me out, sort of psychic stuff. So, and around that time, Vara Bhadri and I were the only women who had children in the movement round here. She had a girl, and but I never felt different. I never felt discriminated against, or, you know, that, I don't know. It wasn't a problem having children for me. And I had a very good friend. Well, she's still a very good friend of mine, who my kids called their pink mummy. And she looked after them when I went on retreat. So I was very fortunate to have her to look after them. And her two kids are still friends with my daughter. So I loved living with my children. And I found that them a spur to my practice, and I still do. You know, especially practicing the speech precepts or being patient. I mean, you can bring everything into practicing with your children. And Lara had the 10 precepts up on the wall. So they're kind of, I mean, sure, she's not a Buddhist, but she kind of is in a way, because she's imbibed it. And she said to me once, "Oh, I'm really glad you meditate, Mum, because my friends' mothers aren't very patient, you know." So, yeah, it was fine. I mean, I think actually on retrospect I probably left them a bit too much, but anyway, that sort of come out of the wash later. So in 83 I was on the team for the open battle retreat in the summer. I don't know if you have open retreats in the summer now, but we used to hire this school in Battle in Sussex, and so there were about 13 of us on the team. Nagabodhi was leading, and there were about 83 people on the retreat. And again, I made loads of friends from that retreat. I was on reception, and it was just fantastic welcoming these people who, like 30 years, they're ordained. A lot of those are ordained now. Now, on that retreat, I was told that Bansi would ordain me, because basically Sangadevi and Marlini had become my Kalyana Mitras, and Marlini was going to Australia and New Zealand, and she wanted me ordained before she went. So she was trying to push me through, you know. So Bansi phoned up, and I was asked, you know, there was a retreat following this open retreat. There was a women's retreat 4 days after the end of that retreat. And could I stay on for this retreat? So I said, well, I could, but I'd have to sort it out with the children, because Mark was mountaineering in Wales and Lara was in the then Yugoslavia, and they'd be back. And I said, well, I could go on that retreat if I left straight after I was ordained. So yeah, that's what happened. So I went to Rottingdean, and there was a little community just outside of Brighton, waited the 4 days in between, and then bought myself a new dress, you know, and went on the retreat. And there was a, on the grounds of this lovely place with a swimming pool, we used to have great retreats there, you know, swimming and, anyway, the science lab was absolutely transformed. It was magical, into the place where Bansi did the private ceremonies. So there was myself, Ratnavandana and Ratnashuri. And it was magic in there. It was just sublime. When I had my private ordination, and I was just over the moon when he gave me my name. It just felt like this person had really seen me. I don't know whether it was probably through conversations we'd had. I'd go and see him when I needed to, because he lived upstairs here, and talk to him about my meditations and my dream life, and, you know, sometimes it was quite profound. And also once I was on a seminar with him at Padmaloka, and I was late for lunch, and I jumped through the window and I nearly landed in his lap when he was sitting to have lunch. So we built up quite a relationship. So when he gave me my name, he said the Ratna, he talked about Ratna as the jewel, but also that the meaning of Ratna was to give. So I've often felt that I kind of give the qualities of the darkening. So, and they're very kind of complex in a way, but I just, you know, it's sky, it's space, skywalker. In fact, when he did my public ordination, he said, well, I haven't quite seen her yet fly through the air with a trail of rainbows from her heels. Yeah. Yeah, so some of the meanings, like, is the absence, or absence of obstruction, or freedom, space, that which moves freely in the mind. Or I also relate to the powerful energies rising up from the depths, or inspirational forces that, you know, rise up and, you know, you're kind of propelled. So the darkening is an embodiment of these upsurging energies, or also another meaning of darkening is spiritual companion. So, and we all have this darkening within us in a way. It's that, you know, when you have that communication that really sparks something off, that darkening energy. So I was as high as a kite for like a year. And and I drove home straight afterwards with Marlene and Sanga Devi in my little mini, you know, like, and the kids were really excited when I got back. But I had this very strong desire to spread the Dharma and to teach, but I was totally more or less uneducated and dyslexic, and I didn't know how I'd do it. But and when I spoke to Bansi, he said, just teach from your experience. And I thought, okay, you know, so, you know, at least you can talk from your experience. So that's what I try to do. And I'm also introverted, so I often find it difficult, you know, when you have these very strong experiences, but it's very difficult to put them into words. So they sometimes come out a bit of a muddle, but anyway, sometimes people get the meaning. So that same year, that was August 83, and that same year in October, the women order members around, you know, in England, decided to have a retreat, which some of you might have heard about. So this was the Muck, another Muck retreat. Actually, we went to Muck because it belonged to Amitra's brother, this kind of rather lovely modern hotel by the sea on the Isle of Muck in Scotland. So 19 of us there were, which was it really. I think nobody got left behind, did they? So 19 of us went, and for a month, and we all gave our life stories, and it was wonderful, you know, walking over the island with these ponies, and I just heard Vajrasattva was there the whole time, you know, just this sort of mantra. And I remember falling into the sea. I was talking to Samatar and had all my waterproofs on because it was pouring with rain, and I walked backwards, and the next minute I was floating in the sea with my waterproofs on. It was amazing, you know, being so buoyant. But it was a wonderful retreat. But at the very end, as some of you might have heard, you know, we had to get the boat back, and it was a raging gale, and we shouldn't have gone because the sea was so rough. The people who ran the boat wouldn't take us, but the guy who owned the hotel said he'd take us, and I've never been on a journey like it. I mean, we were going right up these waves and then coming all the way down, and I was lying on the bottom of the boat, and Ashoka Sri was playing charades with everybody else. Anyway, it was quite a retreat. But and then after that retreat, Padmasuri went back to India, and Marlene left for New Zealand, and I was really, really sad that she was gone. You know, she was going to New Zealand. I carried on with my stained glass work, but I planned a 3-month visit to India, And Padmasuri organised it so that I'd, you know, go on a few women's retreats with her. And I also did a pilgrimage on my own. You know, I went there on my own. I wanted to go on my own. And went up to Darjeeling and Kalimpong and visited Dada Rinpoche, which was absolutely incredible. I've never met a living Bodhisattva before. And just sitting with him, he was amazing to meet me, because he'd spent since about 4 o'clock in the morning on some special celebration day. I mean, there were loads of carters over the shrine, and you know, and I was so looking forward to the Tibetan tea in this great big silver teapot. You know, and when it came, I found it was disgusting. it was a really strange taste. I was really looking forward to it. It must have been a sort of something had built up in my mind that it would be nice, but anyway, I didn't like it. But sitting with him, it was like I didn't want to speak, because it was just so sublime. It felt like speaking was too gross. So some of the time we just sat in silence and, you know, quite at ease and just being with him. It was wonderful. So I returned, and by that time anyway, people had moved on from doing stained glass, so I was doing it on my own. And I was invited by people who worked for Aid for India, which is now Karuna, they asked me whether I wanted to fundraise for the Dharma work in India. Because in those days, they didn't fundraise for Dharma work, they only fundraised for social projects, which Padmasuri was working, well, she was working in health there. She was a nurse. And I jumped at the chance. So I moved my studio back home, and I was working above the cherry orchard in the office there. Okay. So I would organise these fundraising lecture tours while Padmasuri was in India, and then she'd come over, because you could only stay 6 months a year then, so it's probably still the same, and I'd set it all up for when she came, and then we'd go on tour. So we toured England twice, to all the FWBO centres and any other Buddhist centre that would have us, giving this talk and slideshow and raising money for the Dharma in India, for women mainly. And then we went to Germany and did the same thing in Germany, which was very interesting, mainly because people sat there clutching onto their money. And then we went to America. So at the last leg of the tour in America, Manju Vajra organised that with me, and we did the East Coast, some of Canada, and Chicago and Philadelphia, got over to Seattle, and my mother was dying, so I got a call to say, you know, she's not going to last long, so I had to come back. So I missed San Francisco and Vancouver, so I nursed my mother and she died, and that was quite a big effect on our lives. And then Padmasuri got back, and we had both decided that, you know, we wanted to leave London, so she wanted another base from when she came back from India. And because we'd been around all the centres in Britain a couple of times, we knew where we wanted to go, which was Cambridge. And all that was in Cambridge then was Windhorse Trading, which is now Evolution, with a tiny little warehouse. But they were great, they were so friendly, and not that everybody else wasn't friendly, but there was something a bit more. So we decided to move to Cambridge. I went to see Banti, and I was going to be the first one there, so I would literally be the first woman order member, and Padmasuri was coming back from India a bit later. But he said, well, if you go, others will follow, you know, which they did. So Padmasuri and I flatted together, and it was pretty hard going, because she was grieving. That was her leaving India then. I think she'd been there about 8 years, and she was beginning to get very tired. So she came back. She was grieving India and began to write But Little Dust, if any of you have read that book. And I was grieving my mother and all the things that came up around my mother, because we had a pretty difficult relationship. And I was also grieving leaving my kids, because I realised that I was dependent on them being dependent on me. So there was nobody dependent on me. You know, I didn't have a pussycat even. So, you know, it was very hard. I found it very hard. And the guys, Rishiketu and Kulananda, were running classes in the old bathhouse in Cambridge, teaching meditation. And so I joined them there. And then Windhorse funded to buy a community in Newmarket Road, so they allowed two floors of the community to be the centre. So we started a centre, and you know, I taught meditation and got to know people, and you know, the Sangha really grew very quickly. It's enormous now. It was pretty magical, you know, for a little while. But there was something about being in Cambridge that I found difficult. I think partly because it's so flat. I found it very difficult in a flat land. And also it was the town and the gown split. And I was deciding to kind of think, after about 18 months, that I didn't particularly want to stay there. But things were growing at the centre and it was fine. But then one day, we got a phone call. I was home with Padmasura, and it was at lunchtime, which was unusual because calls were expensive at lunchtime then. And it was my daughter to say that my son had died in Greece. He'd been in a road accident. So this sent me into this huge abyss of, you know, my perception of life and death kind of was shattered. It was a bit like, all I could see was this veil between life and death. I mean, my perception was just very, very different of both life and death. And his death really taught me and continues to teach me, especially the fundamental sort of Buddhist teaching of impermanence. You know, everything is unsatisfactory and insubstantial. So he's kind of there all the time, really. And on a deep level, there's always this sense I find within me of being able to drop, well, not being able to, but dropping into a sense of emptiness, which you might relate to or not. But so there's an integration going on over all these years from this experience of losing Mark, from the sort of heights and sort of ecstatic sometimes experience of the freedom of death, you know, because it's seeming, you know, to me sometimes it feels very exciting, to the actual human, you know, just that basic human loss, which is just horrible and shattering and dismal. So there's that integration sort of continues and continues. Gaining more understanding, I suppose. And through this experience, I find that I can also help other people kind of heal the distress in their lives. So at that time, I was still in Cambridge, and I took up training in massage and reflexology, which I found very healing because it was very centering. I was incredibly fragile. To go on an order weekend, I found it very, very difficult because the energies were very dispersed. But being on these, you know, massage and reflexology was very, very grounding and healing, and just understanding the body a bit more. And it made me think, you know, it's amazing the body works, really. You know, it's amazing that we're ever healthy because it's so complex. So, I became more at ease with who I am and continued to kind of go deeper into opening to my own demons and working with my demons and allowing the magic of working with those inner parts of myself to live in this way, really. So it was a very transforming time. I moved back to London, actually. Well, it's a long story, but I nearly got evicted because it was. I'd left the children in the house, and you know, I should have really been there. So I moved back to London, which is what I probably wanted to do anyway, especially being with Lara. And I gradually set up a business with reflexology and massage. Okay. And so I was living back by Hampstead Heath, and I started running meditation classes in Highgate, and really yearned for a centre to be in North London, which I'd wanted before, you know, because driving backwards and forwards was getting more difficult to come over here. Kula Mitra moved back. He moved to London. He'd been in Africa, and he came back and to London. He lived in Crouch End, and he started classes. So we amalgamated our classes, and the Sangha really grew in Crouch End, because there were a lot of people that used to come over here, which were happy to go to Crouch End because it was, you know, they lived in North London. So, yeah, those classes were going along. I was setting up my practice, living with Lara. It was pretty difficult because she'd lost her brother, who she loved. They never used to argue, so it was very, very hard. And I still had this kind of yearning for India. And I also had a yearning to set up a centre in North London. So I wanted to investigate India. And Loka Mitra, who's in India, well, we're old friends from Pundarika days, he organised for me to go to India to lead retreats for the women there for 3 months. That was in 1992. And I started learning Marathi. You know, I'm useless at languages. But I knew I tried, but I didn't pick it up, but anyway. So I went to India, and it was fantastic because it coincided, just by chance, with Bhante's last tour of India. So if you ever get to see, or if you've seen the you know, DVDs of Bhante in India, it's absolutely amazing. You know, there'd be stages like 15 feet high with hundreds and hundreds of people coming, and they would walk for miles to come to his talks. It's just incredible to see. It was a real privilege, and often, you know, so every talk would be singing and dancing before his talk, and then he'd be garlanded over and over again by people. There'd be a red carpet and flowers strewn, and it was just absolutely amazing. And sometimes they'd say, "Now you garland Bhante," you know, and he'd say, "Who's this one from?" You know, "Oh, Tara Loka," they said, you know. So it was wonderful. And I was leading these retreats with women, and living in the women's community at the girls' hostel, giving talks sometimes, which was it's quite good fun, actually, because someone translates, so you have a lot of time to think. you know, sometimes there'd be rats running around as you gave a talk, but anyway. No, it was wonderful. Had really beautiful time with the women there, and it was lovely. So I came back and I had these two decisions in a way. You know, was I going to go to India regularly, or was I going to help set up a centre? But I chose to help set up the centre in North London because it was mainly the language. Because to go deeper, when I was trying to lead study, well, I was leading study, but to try and go deeper leading study was quite hard because of the culture difference and trying to understand what people really meant. So I thought, well, my English is a bit better than Marathi, so I'll carry on with the English way. And so I got back and spoke to Kula Mitra and Kula Nanda and said, okay, you know, how about this centre? And luckily, Kula Mitra, who's very generous with his money, he funded us. So we got a property just off the Holloway Road and started a centre. And I said, you know, the one thing we don't need to do is to think of this place as a small centre. So we never did, and it's really has grown, as probably some of you know. Where am I? So the centre grew, and Karuna, by that time, they'd gone to Oxford, and then they moved back, and they moved above us in North London, in St Mark's Studios. And also, we had what was called the FWBO Communications Office there, with Vishwapani and Kulananda and Guhipati. And I was the only woman all the member, and there were a lot of lovely guys, and yeah, we all got on very well. But I think it was my fullest and most challenging 7 years in the movement. I formed a community of three. Lara left home by then, and she moved up the hill with our dog, our lovely Cocker Spaniel. So she'd often come down, and I formed a community on the basis that she could come and go as she wanted, which we often had hope there, Ashoka Sri. We lived together. So we had combinations of different people living together, but it was, it, you know, for those of you who live in community, it's a good practice. I was also teaching meditation courses at the centre, leading Sangha night, doing different classes, retreat leader, you know, where we'd carry on going to National Trust places in Kent and Sussex, taking all the cushions, taking all the food, you know, all the bit, going on retreat. I was Kalyana Mitra to various people, and obviously, you know, building up friendships again. I think I'm KM to about 8 people in 4 different countries at the moment. I used to go to Finland and Estonia once a year to lead retreats, so got to know people there very well. And I was also on the council and helped run the centre. So this was all unfunded, so I needed to earn a living. And I did that with my massage and reflexology to a certain extent. So I used to have a room at Bodywise, room at home, a room in other people's homes sometimes, and sometimes treat people at the centre. So it was a bit of a juggling act, you know, knowing which hat I was wearing, and you know, but it was good for my practice, and I was very mindful of what I was doing. So over our time there, I suppose first of all, Kula Mitra was chairman, and during his time as chair, we had Women, Men, and Angels fluffed up the dust, and. And then with Yasha Mitra became our second chairman, and of course while he was chairman we had him writing the letter outing Banti's sexuality. Well, neither of these things really bothered me because I knew about Banti from Richard, and I was perfectly well aware that women had spiritual aptitude, so I didn't quite understand why people got a bit hot under the collar about it. But and being Mitra convener, I was trying to help people, but at the same time, it was like, you know, I couldn't quite relate to where they were coming from. But because in the days of early days in the movement, you know, we were mostly all pretty promiscuous. So anyway, those things have, you know, become history in a way now. But it was a very sort of intense, I suppose the word would be. Intense time, a lot of the time. Okay. So during this time too, I'd go on my... I usually would take a month solitary a year. And I went on 2 retreats with Prakasha at Butterfield. So there was a Guru Yoga retreat 1 year and a Chod practice the next year. And After those retreats, I just felt that I wanted the meditative experience, or I wanted my life to be like the meditative experience of coming off a retreat rather than arriving on it. Yeah, I was too busy, basically. And so I gave a year's notice with the North London Centre, And I put the house up for sale, and that sold. And I went to stay with my friend Sarah, and I did not know what I wanted to do. So I used to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning with this absolute dread. You know, I'd wake up and just open to this sort of empty chasm, but know and trust somewhere that I would eventually know what I wanted to move towards. And but I knew what I didn't want to move towards. So, for instance, I contemplated various options like be on the team at Tara Loca or T. Ratnaloka. That felt too sort of hemmed in for me. So various things. So I kind of knew it's either going to come in a meditation or a dream. It actually came in a puja when we were at the North London Centre, and it was a thought followed a thought, and it was New Zealand. So it was a eureka experience. I couldn't sleep that night, so I knew that it was the right thought. And it was this yearning to meditate in a vast, psychic, clearer space. I mean, New Zealand's very unpopulated, Britain's very overpopulated. There's a lot of history in Britain, which is fantastic, but it has its own sort of psychic muck, if you like. Whereas New Zealand's very free of history, it's a very young country. I had three friends there, three very, very deep friends, one being Marlene, and so I organised with the chairperson at Auckland to get me a work visa, and with the understanding that I'd only do a tiny little bit at the centre, but it was to get me into the country. Okay, sorry. So I found this fabulous place in the bush by the sea, and I just loved being there. I never got homesick once. I never thought of England much at all. And just embedded in my practice, really, it was just incredible for a few months. And then the chairman was very ill and he resigned. And the women's mitra convener in Auckland resigned because she also got ill. And two other order members who were like the mainstay, the other two mainstay, they both left. And so they needed help. So I couldn't not really respond. And so I became involved in classes and running the centre and became mitra convener. Friendships blossomed. It was fine. You know, the one stipulation I had was that I wasn't disturbed until midday. So I actually carried on quite a strong practice until midday, and then I'd go in because I lived outside of Auckland. But it was a wonderful opportunity living in another country. The moon was upside down and the stars were upside down and the water goes down the plug the different way. And I found it really interesting living in a country that was a colony of Britain. I'd never, Britain thinks it's it. It's really interesting being on the other side for 7 years and seeing how people are affected by, I'd have to be really careful of saying, well, in England, we do it this way, So, yeah, it was a real learning curve. I also got to know the Maori culture and had a Maori friend, and I also connected with a Maori past life there. So it was really, really fantastic time. And again, I made some wonderful, wonderful friends there. And my daughter Lara came over for a visit. She bought her portfolio because she's an artist, and then she applied with her portfolio to go to Auckland University to study fine art and sculpture, and she got a place. So she came over to New Zealand. She got a 3.5 year visa. She brought our lovely dog Hope. So there I was looking after Hope again. And she lived in the bush just near me. And so, yeah, it was wonderful having her again and, you know, being so near. And I was on the ordination team, and we'd have retreats in Australia and New Zealand. So I got to know people in Australia. I was teaching, as the time went by, 3 or 4 classes a week. Retreats at Afitu and Sudarshana Loka. And sort of always had this sort of... Well, the Bodhisattva idea has always been very strong in the movement and strong within me, and it was like this pulsating sort of, you know, pulse kept pulsing, really. And it was there that I became a private preceptor. And I explored New Zealand extensively, often on my own. I'd just go off, and especially in the Maori areas around the East Cape and right up north. I just loved it. And the South Island, and I managed to go from there. I mean, the thing is, you know, it's amazing being in England, because you can go to Europe on holiday. It's like, where do you go on holiday? And at the end of the world sort of thing. Well, I did go to South America. So I went to Machu Picchu in Peru, and the Amazon jungle, and that was pretty awesome. And went over to the Barrier Reef in New Zealand, in Australia, which was stunning. But as well as exploring externally, I went very deep internally. I kind of, living where I lived, by that time was up in a friend's batch, further up north, again by the sea, a pretty isolated place. And it was there that I really, really penetrated some really, really deep stuff that I sort of cleared and healed and integrated. So it was a very, very formative time there. Lara's degree, she got her degree, and she needed to leave. So Hope went back with Lara. And I had continued to get work visas, and during that time I was applying for residency, but I was a year too old. So I had to apply for a special dispensation from the Minister of Immigration, and I'd drop him a postcard every now and then, you know, would you please consider my application as a Minister of Religion? So I had a huge amount, like a wadge of letters from people that I knew in the movement, you know, backing my practice, and yeah, which was quite affirming. And I eventually got my residency, and the Minister of Immigration wrote and said, I don't usually get involved in matters like this, but on this occasion, you know. And I was very excited, you know, pleased to get my residency. And I eventually came back to Britain for a visit, and I trained in breathworks. I did the first stage with breathworks, went on a convention, and Lara saw me off at the airport, and she was pretty devastated at my leaving, and I stopped off in Australia to lead a retreat there. So of course I phoned her to say I've got back all right, and she wouldn't answer the phone, and I was really, really worried that she wouldn't answer the phone. Well, eventually she did, just before the retreat started, and she said, you know, I just feel you abandoned me. You know, you've always abandoned me. So she had this big abandonment issue. Anyway, I led the retreat, and I thought, you know, I'll deal with it when I get back to New Zealand. So I got back to New Zealand, and we talked, and I was already re-evaluating what I was doing, because I was beginning to get very tired. I suppose 6 or more years had gone by, and I'd got incredibly busy again. And also the Sangha had grown, so the women had been getting ordained, which was fantastic, and they were gradually taking things on again. So and I was beginning to get pretty weary, So I knew that my energy wasn't going to last out. I couldn't keep up doing what I was doing in the way I was doing it. So something had to change. So I'd got back anyway, thinking, now how can I, you know, how can I re-evaluate my life again? But Lara asked me to return to Britain, and I talked it over with quite a number of people who, you know, most didn't have children, and I knew I needed to think about it on a really gut level, and on a gut level I knew that I needed to come back because I needed to help her have faith in me again, or regain her faith in me, because there's a lot of love between us, and it's an important relationship to me. So Lara's a space hopper. She's also gone off to different countries and lived. She's lived in Jamaica, Australia, Spain. So I kind of thought, she won't be in England long. I'll go back, you know, for quite however long it takes, and then I'll go back to New Zealand. So I put my stuff in storage, came back, but I thought, well, I've got to do, you know, I need to be, where do I need to be? Well, I needed to be in space because I needed psychic space. So I decided to live by the sea in Sussex, which, just by chance, it's only 25 miles from where I was brought up, underneath the South Downs. It's really odd. That's where I was brought up. So it's not far from there, which I loved. And I was in culture shock for months, actually, getting back into Britain, but I gradually got used to it again. I was like a shaking jelly. And I finished my training with Breathworks and trained in MBCT and started setting up courses along the South Coast and at the Brighton Buddhist Centre. But something in me, I never planned it. I'm about 9 miles from Brighton Centre. And I've got very old friends in Brighton, so I belong to a chapter there. But there was something in me that just didn't feel propelled to teach as much as I'd been doing all the years up until I came back. So it was another of those cases of kind of knowing what I wanted to do, but knowing what I didn't feel drawn to do. So I was really surprised, and it's taken me quite a number of years to adjust to not being that person. It's my truth in a way. So I tend to move towards cultivating friendships, and especially with the people that I'm, you know, possible being a preceptor to, and the person I have become a preceptor to. I'm again doing more and more of less and less, if you like. There's a more meditative sense of my life. And another thing to add is that when I got back to Britain, I met up with Richard, because Lara was working something out from an astrologer, you know, because we're into astrology too. And he said, oh, there's something in 76 you need to integrate in your life, you know. So we kind of, that was when we were living with Richard, you know. So I met up with Richard for a short walk on the heath, and like 7 hours later we were still talking. So the love between us just got reignited, and we're now living together in Lancing. And which is brilliant. I mean, it's just so nice to be in a, very, very nurturing relationship. I'm still teaching meditation, and it's mainly to very small groups of people who are either suffering from chronic pain or stress and anxiety, and we can go really deep with their process, and I just love working on that level. At the moment I've got a lady who's terminal in the group, and it's just really, really moving to be able to work with people in that way. And I'm also grateful that I can give give expression to my imagination again. I stopped doing stained glass when I moved back from London from Cambridge. I've never done it since. And I started tapestry weaving a year or so ago, and I just love it. It's so meditative. And so I found this wonderful teacher in Angmering, and I've sort of become part of the weaving world, you know. And I've also got an allotment in Shoreham, which, I'm planting lots of seed at the moment, ready to go into my allotment. So I feel very nurtured, living by the sea, living under the downs. Come to rest in meditation and free in a way, far more of the obstruction of too much activity. It's not what I want to do anymore. I just find experiencing my mind with less activity is just it's so necessary, in a way, to go even deeper into somehow who I am or my being. So I'm sort of still on the road to discovery, but it just feels right. And I feel very blessed to and inspired to be part of this wonderful Tree Ratna and, you know, its future, and its future is you all. So thank you for listening.